Fred Starner, Why Do They Hate Us? You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Haider is an Iraqi woman, a mother, and a teacher. She arrived in Los Angeles last week through the work of organizations like No More Victims. Her older son, Haider, was killed by a U.S. missile during the first Gulf War in 1999, and her younger son, 8-year-old Mustafa, now accompanies her for medical treatment from missile shrapnel wounds. Sonali Kalhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles spoke with Haider recently about her trip to the U.S., where she is from in Iraq, and who she has left behind.
I'm from the south of Iraq, Basra governorate.
Who have you left behind?
I have my husband and my two children.
And your family is waiting for you in Iraq?
I have some news from my parents' family in Baghdad. But till now in Basra, I didn't know anything about them. Maybe they find or not, I don't know.
You haven't heard from your husband yet?
No. But some people travel to Basra and they tell me if they, I give them the address, if they can meet with them and know how are they. They will tell me. But till now, no, no news.
And how does it make you feel to see on TV that there are U.S. forces in your hometown now?
It's very hard to see your country and your home occupied by strange forces, enemy forces. But I can't do nothing. I just sitting in front of the TV and I cry. My tears fall down.
What about your other son, Haider? Can you talk about him?
Because on 1999... an American missile fell down on our area on Monday, the 25th of January, 1999, at 9:30 in the morning. An American missile fell down on our area and destroyed 67 homes, and injured people were 65 people, and killed 4 children. 3 girls and my son Haider. The 4th were dead. Just children.
This was Operation Desert Fox under President Clinton. When we talk about today what's happening in the United States, George Bush tells us that he went into Iraq to get rid of Saddam Hussein and that we have now liberated Iraqi people.
From what he liberated us? To kill civilian people, it's too bad to make a resolution or to stop problems. We need this life. If we need to kill the civilian people, the children, the women, the old people, we need our life. We are not, we didn't need this kind of liberation. To face with a sanction, it's very hard. You have no medicine in hospitals. You have no food. You know, you have no dresses. You have nothing. And no jobs, no good salary. It's very, very hard. I can't translate it or explain the real situation, how much I talk.
Talk about your son Mustafa.
Mustafa, till now, from 1999 till now, he's suffering from many, many things. At the beginning, Iraqi doctors take care of him. They immediately 2 fingers from his left hand destroyed. They cut half on his hand, and a piece of missile entered from his bag, settled in his liver. The doctor cut a part of his liver. And all of his body is full of pieces of missile. Some of them are big and some the others small. The very dangerous piece is between his bone, of his backbone and his, I think it's the hip. When he move or walk, it crush the both of bones. it's very dangerous to if it to stay in this place. Iraqi doctor said we can't make this operation to get it out because it's hard in Iraq. In Basra, the mother's life is very, very hard because sometimes they can't feed their children. Not in a good way, just feed them. We have many kinds of cancer and leukemia and many, many things. Till now, the people suffering from these very hard condition diseases.
Who did most Iraqi people blame? Did they look at Saddam Hussein with his fancy palaces? Did they blame the United States? What was the sense?
They didn't blame because it's our fate to make us deal with the life in this way.
There is a new governor in Basra that the United States has put in place there. So when you go back, inshallah, your family will be safe. You will have a new government, a new everything maybe. Yeah. What do you hope for the future?
I hope the Iraqi people live with peace and welfare, and they have good life, to real life, not only for many days. And inshallah, the days will tell us.
Also, you must have heard in Baghdad that the museums, the Iraqi museums, are all gone. How do you feel about that history wiped out?
Yeah, I feel very sorry because those people, they didn't know what they... I saw them, the museum. It's very, very value. It's very beautiful. When you enter, you can find all the worth of our history. Our history is very, very great. And they didn't know they destroy. They destroy, not maybe the enemy encouraged them. I don't know, but they destroy our history. Their history in their hands. But they didn't know what they do.
Some reports are saying that the United States forces, they didn't stop the looters, and instead the U.S. forces protected the Ministry of Oil in Baghdad. How do you feel?
Of course, because the oil is the aim. As I think, I don't know it's really or not, but because the oil is their aim.
Do others in Iraq feel the same way?
Of course, most of Iraqi.
What do you think the United States wants?
I think they need to control the Arabs. They like Arabs.
Haider, an Iraqi woman in the United States, seeking medical treatment for her 8-year-old son, Mustafa, hit by shrapnel from a U.S. missile. She was speaking with Sonali Kolhatkar from Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles to find out about how you can contribute to Haider's son's medical treatment fund. Please visit www.nomorevictims.org. As all the world's attention is focused for the time being on Iraq, many people seem to have forgotten about Afghanistan, where life has still not improved substantially for much of the population, despite their supposed liberation by American forces. Reporter Mohammed Mujibur-Rahman explores the impact of the war in Iraq on his native country. He fears, like many of his countrymen, that the conflict in Iraq is diverting the international community's efforts away from the reconstruction of his own country, shattered by a quarter of a century of war.
If you travel around the city of Kabul, you can easily see the signs of reconstruction everywhere, from rebuilding of the peace infrastructure to rebuilding of the minds of the people. But the main objective, which was peace, is not yet fully accomplished. When you walk through Afghan bazaars, the smell and sign of Iranian products can be felt and seen everywhere. Almost 75% of the stuff is imported from Iran, while Iranian markets are highly affected by the Iraqi war. And consequently, the prices of this stuff have risen in Afghan markets. The mood on the streets of Kabul is quite normal, and everywhere it's business as usual. Hundreds of yellow and white taxis in the center of the city, with an enormous number of bicycles, have made a big, noisy traffic jam like every day. Local radio stations keep the people updated of the progress made in the Iraqi war. But people in general are too busy with their own problems to think about the issues beyond the borders of their country. Nevertheless, there is a general idea that the U.S. did not learn from the experience of its attacks in Afghanistan. The attention of the international community will switch from Afghanistan to Iraq, and the slow speed of reconstruction in Afghanistan will slow down even more. People start to lose their patience if more civilians are mistakenly killed by American bombs, while a newly born resentment against American armed men is clearly seen on the faces of the people.
Reporter Mohammed Mujibur-Rahman in Kabul, Afghanistan. Well, from Kabul, Afghanistan, we now move to Dakar, Senegal, where people share common concerns about the U.S. war and occupation of Iraq. Salif Saidi is a 16-year-old student who grew up in the United States and is now living in Senegal. Speaking recently with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian, he offers his unique perspective and the expressions of people he interviewed regarding the war against Iraq.
I interviewed a few people at my school and who I live around, and the general feeling I'm getting is that it was a war for oil and to dominate the region, more or less. For example, I talked to one person here, and they said that it's a war for petrol or oil, and therefore not a just war. You cannot fight a war for oil. More or less, that's what I'm hearing. Oil war, or to colonize, stuff like that.
So the majority of the Senegalese people, you think, are opposed to the war?
Yes, yeah, I'm going to say that pretty certainly. Mm-hmm. And most of the people in West Africa are opposed to the war, because the West African people, or at least in most West African countries, no war. The Senegalese fought a battle, a war, so to speak, with Mauritania, which is to the north of the country. I talked with some people in Ivory Coast. They are in the process of a war right now. So, you know, most people in this area know war, and they know it's not good. So not a lot of people are for it.
And can you speak a little bit about what's been going on there? I know that you've taken part in some actions at your school, some walkouts and things like that.
Well, Madist, the motto almost from Madist is peace. There is a phrase in Wolof, which is the local language here, Jamarek, which basically means peace or be at peace. And the school itself has, I don't think, taken any formal statement on the war, but the students have said we are opposed to this. There was a small demonstration at the school not too long ago, and basically just saying we are opposed to this, we don't like it, we don't think war is the right action to go. So the students here are very opposed to it, as well as the general public.
Mm-hmm. Are demonstrations of any sort common there?
Common? No. Do they happen? Yes. There was a demonstration not too long ago in the city where I think more than 1,000 people probably showed up, and they protested in the streets with anti-Bush, anti-war, and I think there was some anti-American sentiments. But for the most part, it's been anti-Bush, anti-war kind of stuff.
And do people there have questions for you as someone who grew up and lived for many years in the United States?
Yeah. They basically ask, are all Americans like this? But there are a few times when I get questions about, you know, what's this all about? Why are they doing this? Do they want, you know, to dominate the region? Do they want to to alienate themselves from everybody, or, you know, do they really think this is necessary? More general questions like, what's life like in the States? Or, you know, is everyone rich? Does everyone have big cars?
Mm-hmm. I hear that you listen to Pacifica Radio on shortwave there in Senegal.
Yeah, I do.
What do you listen? You listen to Democracy Now?
I do. And for many years before leaving the States, I listened to Democracy Now. On the way to school in the morning. So I'm a fan of Democracy Now. I go to there's a cyber cafe right across the street from us, and so I read whatever comes out from WPFW, anything else that comes out from the area, from DC in general. I try and keep up with what's on the radio.
Yep. Well, any final thoughts you wanted to add?
Yeah. The Senegalese, I got a statement from some people here. The Senegalese people are, for the most part, Muslim. So they want to side with their brothers and sisters in arms, or their compatriots. And the president here, though most people support him, has big plans for Senegal. And these plans require money from the U.S. or the U.S. government. So they feel they understand but don't agree with the fact that in order for them to advance themselves as a developing country, they cannot at one hand receive funds from the U.S. and on the other hand be against the war. So they're put into a constraint, a bind, if you will, in order to advance themselves, but on the other hand be against the war. And they want that to stop. They want to be able to advance as a country, but not automatically have to be with the U.S. and their war. A lot of other people have been saying to me that they think the United States is a warlike society. One person said to me, in the past 50 or 60 years after the World War II, almost every single war has had America behind it or some way involved in it. And they feel that for America to survive, they need war, which I found a very shocking statement.
16-year-old Salif Saidi is a student who grew up in the United States and is now living in Senegal. He was speaking with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian. Meanwhile, in Namibia, southwestern Africa, three high school students from Maine are learning how Namibians feel about the United States and the war in Iraq. Here's reporter Julie Joy.
I feel far removed from the national panic, from the protests, the constant news bulletins, and the government-issued terrorist warnings of the United States. Growing up in Maine, I took for granted what a privileged life I lived. I never questioned that I would always have a toilet and running water, which are luxuries for many Namibians. Along with adapting to the Namibian ways of life, I have also been exposed to a culture of people who know too well the realities of war and the value of peace. Almost every day, a Namibian will ask, "What is your country doing in Iraq?" And every time, I am embarrassed by the question. I don't agree with the choices that the United States government is making, and I hate to explain U.S. foreign policy when I, myself, don't understand the motivations behind it. All that people in Namibia see in the newspapers are pictures of American and British soldiers armed to the teeth, an unsettling and frightening reminder of the violence of the Namibian War for Liberation, which ended only 13 years ago. The families that I've stayed with here are also adamant about keeping up with the international news. Just a donkey cart ride away from the rural farming village of Correjas, our host families gather around radios to hear the news delivered in several indigenous languages of Namibia, as well as English, the official language of the country. Caitlin Boyce remembers this vividly.
One day when I was sitting under the only tree watching the goats, the hourly news came on in Damara, the mother tongue of my host family. The only words I could understand were Iraq, missiles, and United States. I was so frustrated that I couldn't understand what was going on in the world or what my country was doing because of the language barrier.
Being here in Namibia is helping me and my classmates look at the United States through international eyes and understand the economic power that the U.S. holds in the world. From here, the United States seems like such an egocentric bully. I really don't feel like the U.S. is considering that its actions will have consequences for people all over the world, including Namibia. For many young Namibians, it's the first time they've seen the U.S. in a negative light. Many people in Namibia see America as a land that still flows with milk and honey, a place where they can find jobs, feed their children, and be free from the legacy of apartheid and colonialism. Caitlin explains one experience dealing with these misconceptions.
I teach an English as a foreign language class for some women educators. One class session, a woman asked me when I was going home to the United States and if she could come back to America with me. I asked her why she wanted to go to the U.S. She said, "Things are cheap there, and I will make lots of money." The other teacher, Paul, started explaining the relative cost of living in the U.S. He showed the women how a typical teacher in the United States would be in debt after paying for only rent and food. The women were shocked and could not believe that life in the U.S. could ever be hard for anyone.
Many people in Namibia think that everyone in the U.S. lives well. When I debunk misconceptions, I try to recognize that this isn't true for all Americans. The problems that exist in Namibia also exist in the U.S., although not to the same degree. Some people in the United States still go hungry and live and die on the streets. There is still racism, sexism, and poverty. The people still live apart, the rich in their area and the poor somewhere else. I want to be able to represent our country proudly, but I do not feel that I can do so at the present time, and I'm not alone since my fellow students feel the same way. As Badisha found out, other Americans abroad share our sentiments.
Today I met an American doctoral student in downtown Windhoek. She told me that she's so embarrassed to be associated with the U.S. right now that she now tells everyone that she's Canadian. She advised me to do the same and gave me a crash course in talking with a Canadian accent.
And no matter what individual Americans think about war with Iraq, the world sees the United States as one unified force, embodied by George W. Bush. Unfortunately, right now, his voice is not reflective of all of our voices. My fellow students and I, as citizens of the United States of America, do not support this war. It is not in the best interest of any nation or person in this world, and I cannot stand to see our country act out of greed and a desire to save face. Such actions are never tolerable.
That was Julie Joy for Blunt Youth Radio at community radio station WMPG in Portland, Maine. As people throughout the world express their concerns and frustrations over the U.S.-led invasion and occupation of Iraq, closer to home, protests continue. While some polls suggest that the majority of Americans support President Bush, CNN surveyed its viewers yesterday on the question, was the anti-war movement right? And 65% of the people responded yes. This question has also been on the mind of author and syndicated columnist Arianna Huffington, who says it is too soon for Pentagon and White House officials to celebrate a victory in Iraq.
The Bible tells us that pride goeth before the fall. In Iraq, it came right after it. From the moment that statue of Saddam hit the ground, the mood around the Rumsfeld campfire has been all high fives, I told you so's, and endless smug prattling about how the speedy fall of Baghdad is proof positive that those who opposed the invasion of Iraq were dead wrong. What utter nonsense. In fact, the speedy fall of Baghdad proves the anti-war movement was dead right. The whole pretext for our unilateral charge into Iraq was that the American people were in imminent danger from Saddam and his mighty war machine. The threat was so clear and present that we couldn't even give inspectors searching for weapons of mass destruction. Hey, remember those? Another 30 days, as France had wanted. Well, it turns out that far from being on the verge of destroying Western civilization, Saddam and his 21st century Gestapo couldn't even master a half-hearted defense of their own capital. The hawk's cakewalk disproves their own dire warnings. They can't have it both ways. The invasion has proved widely successful in one other regard. It has unified most of the world, especially the Arab world, against us. In fact, almost everything about the invasion, from the go-it-alone build-up to the mayhem the fall of Saddam has unleashed, has played right into the hands of those intent on demonizing our country. Islamic extremists must be having a field day signing up recruits for the holy war they are preparing to wage against us. Instead of Uncle Sam wants you, the recruiting posters feature a different kind of patriotic image, an American soldier ill-advisedly draping the American flag over Saddam's face. The anti-war movement did not oppose the war out of fear that America was going to lose. It was the Bush administration's pathological and frantic obsession with an immediate damn-the-consequences invasion that fueled the protests. And please don't point to jubilant Iraqis dancing in the streets to validate the case for preemptive liberation. You'd be doing the Baghdad boogaloo, too, if the murderous tyrant had been eating off golden plates while your family starved, finally got what was coming to him. It in no way proves that running roughshod over international law and pouring Iraqi oil onto the flames of anti-American hatred was a good idea. It wasn't before the war, and it still isn't now. The unintended consequences have barely begun to unfold. And the idea that our slam dunk of Saddam actually proves the White House was right is particularly dangerous, because it encourages the Wolfowitzes and the Pearls and the Cheneys to argue that we should be invading Syria or Iran or North Korea or Cuba as soon as we catch our breath. They've tasted blood now. It's important to remember that the Arab world has seen a very different war than we have. They are seeing babies with limbs blown off, children wailing beside their dead mothers, Arab journalists killed by American tanks and bombers, holy men hacked to death and dragged through the streets. They are seeing American forces leaving behind a wake of destruction, looting, hunger, humiliation, and chaos. And the powerful role that shame and humiliation have played in shaping world history is considerable, but something the Bush team seems utterly clueless about, which is why the anti-war movement must be stalwart in its refusal to be silenced or browbeaten by the gloating I told you so chorus on the right. On the contrary, it needs to make sure that the doctrine of preemptive invasion is forever buried in the sands of Iraq, especially as the administration, high on the heady fumes of Saddam's ouster, turns its covetous eyes on Syria. I give it less than a week before someone starts making the case that President Assad is the next Hitler.
Author Arianna Huffington, her most recent book is titled Pigs at the Trough, How Corporate Greed and Political Corruption Are Undermining America. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adel Hamid of KPFA, Claire Holman, and Benta Berkland. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org or calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Without your financial support, Peace Watch will cease to exist as of May 1st. It's your financial support that makes this program possible. So please pledge your support through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. Send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. We can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.